let us we'll turn to the Torah portion for this evening. And this is an interesting one. They're always interesting, I think. But this one is, if anything, a little bit, well, in some respects, kind of like last week. There are some puzzling aspects to it. It begins in chapter 22. So turn to Numbers or Bamidbar, chapter 22. Let's see what it says here. And the children of Israel, everybody knows that's the Bnei Israel, journeyed. They pitched in the plains of Moab, beyond the Jordan, at Jericho. And verse 2 is where we begin. And Balak, son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. Now, Balak is then the name of the portion. That's the first unique word in here. And saw Balak all that Israel had done to the Amorites, and it upset him. He was sore afraid of the people, because there were a lot of them. Moab was overcome with dread because of the children of Israel, and Moab, in the form of their leader, said unto the elders of Midian, "Well, now this multitude all around us, they're gonna, just like the ox licketh up the grass of the field, they're gonna lick everything up around here." Balak, son of Zippor, was king of Moab at that time, so he sent some messengers unto a fellow who was pretty renowned. This is where the plot thickens. It gets kind of interesting, and what I'm going to do is pause after I read this first verse, and we'll talk a little bit about some of the character study, because if anything, this portion tonight has some interesting character stuff, actually has a little bit of humor. A lot of times the Torah does, but this is probably one of the more stand-up comedy-related routines in the Torah. When we get to that in a little while, it's going to tell us about Bilaam. Some people say Balaam in English, but Bilaam, who had some messengers come to him. He's the son of Beor, and they basically sent some. The king sent some folks to this people, saying, "Hey, look, there's a people that are coming up out of Mitzrayim, out of Egypt, and they're covering the whole face of the earth, and they abide over against me. So come on down here, you prophet, you Bilaam. I pray you, curse for me this people, because they're too mighty for me. I need to prevail against them, that we might smite them and drive them out of the land. For I know." Now here's where the plot thickens. "I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed." Does that sound familiar? Everybody remember those words? It's a slightly different phraseology, but it's the same concept. "I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you." Now, if you begin to think, interesting, there might be some parallels here with the story of Abraham, who to a great extent was a prophet. He spoke to Yah. He was told some things. He was made a covenant and some promises. And if there's some parallels between him and Bilaam, there are more than just a few. The sages over the years have looked at this story. Well, as I go through it, we'll point out a couple of the more obvious ones and kind of see what that implies. You can certainly run this comparison between Abraham and Bilaam, the prophet. There are others that will point out that, this guy, Balaam, was considered to be the greatest of all of the non-Israelite prophets, the pagan prophets, if you will. And you can look and you can see other people in history that are not prophets of Yah that have achieved some notoriety. I was thinking about it a little while ago. You got people like, some of them will claim to be Christians, and, who knows for sure. Probably the most famous prophet, his ethnicity evidently was of the nation of, or at least one of the tribes of Israel, but he seemed to have gone occult in his later life, and of course that's a fellow named Nostradamus. People still think Nostradamus was this fabulous prophet. And of course, there's some dispute about that. But in other words, it is not without some precedent, either later or before, that there are such things as prophets who are not of Israel. And as I mentioned, some of the sages, one of the things that you'll sometimes hear Balaam referred to as the non-Israelite Moses. And of course, there are some real differences. As we go through the story of Balaam and Balak here, we'll talk about some of the differences, because if there's a confusing aspect to this whole story, it's, you could kind of summarize it as, well, what kind of prophet is this guy? what is it that ultimately sets him in a little different place, besides the fact that he doesn't seem to have... Well, he's a prophet for hire, for one. He doesn't seem to have quite the same pure motivations that some of the other prophets do. Of course, there's a lot of other things that you can and will say about him. Sometimes the sages have pointed out, well, unlike Moshe, for example, he had a haughty spirit. He wasn't so much humble. This guy thought of himself as being kind of... If there was a mega church of the day, Bilaam would have been the Joel Osteen or fill in the blanks up there talking to God or somebody and profiting along the way. Am I drawing a connection? No, that's probably not a great connection either, but there aren't that many great connections. He was a little bit unusual. Now, one other observation I'll make here, I saw this referenced a couple places. When it comes to Bilaam of Peor, son of Peor, there are actually historical pieces of archaeological data that use that name. So not only was this guy famous around the world at the time, he still finds, we still see some record of him, if you will, in the history books. There are Egyptian pottery fragments that date from the second millennium BCE. And they have been found containing various kinds of texts or curses that were directed against Canaanite cities. Oh, maybe that's one of those other things that might separate Balaam apart. We don't necessarily... Now, we see Moses, for example, issuing prophetic warnings. If you do these things, you'll be blessed. If you do these other things, you'll be cursed. But I don't recall... I'm going to say this carefully. I don't recall, for example, seeing Moshe or other prophets explicitly cursing people, particularly not for money, the way that Bilaam did. Now, again, you see warnings, the prophecies of Scripture from, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Jeremiah, Hosea, they're all full of warnings. Hey, if Israel doesn't repent, bad stuff is going to happen. But we don't see them specifically cursing so much. Anyway, these texts, these curses, literally have been found on various kinds of pottery. It was evidently a custom among pre-Islamic Arabs to hire poets to be supposedly under the divine influence to compose curses against their enemy. And back in 1967, there was a plaster inscription that was found on the wall of a temple in Deir Allah in Jordan. And it made reference to the night visions of a seer whose name was Bilaam, of son of Peor. And what is remarkable about this is it's considered to be the earliest reference in all of archaeology to an individual that was named in the Torah. And it's ironic that he would be a pagan in that sense. And yet, here's the funny part. It does appear this guy did talk to Yah, right? What is going on here? It is. It's a little bit confusing. So let's go through the story, see if there aren't some pieces of this that begin to fall out. King comes to him, sends messengers, asks him to curse these folks. Elders of Moab and Midian departed. They had the rewards of divination in their hand. Now, here's another question that comes up. Was this guy a magician or a sorcerer? How does he do these things? Maybe he had, the televangelist blessing upon him, and he used TV. I don't know. But the guys come to him. They spoke the words that they were authorized to speak on behalf of the king, right, as a messenger coming in the name of the king, Balak. And he said to them, stay here this night. I'll bring you back word, as Yahuwah may speak unto me. So the princes of Moab stayed there. And here Elohim comes to Balaam. And he said, this too is a... another one of those interesting places. He asks a question. You think he knows the answer? When God asks a question, you would generally get the idea he knows the answer. But this, too, is of some interest. Who are these men with you? We figure he knows. Sometimes there is, we see that he asks Adam a question. Adam, where are you? He knows where Adam is. He asks Cain a question. He knows what's going on with Cain. He asked Balaam a question. I bet he knows what's going on here, too. In this particular case, there is some kind of an interaction going on And the creator of the universe is setting something up. Obviously, he pretty much has an idea of the character of this man, and maybe what's going to happen. Balaam says unto Elohim, Balak, son of Zippor, king of Moab, has sent to me. And he says, behold, there are these folks coming out of Egypt. They cover the face of the earth, so curse them for me, so that he can fight against them and then drive them out. And at this point, Elohim says to Balaam the following. Now listen to this. I would suggest that it is unequivocal. No doubt about it. You shall not go with them. You shall not curse the people, for they are blessed. Let me put a period, exclamation point, into sentence. Close quote. Balaam rose up in the morning. He says unto the princes of Balak, well, get back to your land, for Yahuwah refuses to give me leave to go with you. Partial credit, right? It's at least partially true. It's good old 80-20 rule stuff. You notice he kind of left the door open a little bit. Princes of Moab rose up. They went unto Balak, told him, hey, the guy refuses to come with us. So Balak sends more princes, better, higher level. You know, those were kind of like the second tier. Now he sends the first team, more honorable. They come to Balaam, and they said to him, here, now the king says, let nothing, I pray you, hinder you from coming along with us. We're up in the ante here, guys. I'll promote you this very great honor. Anything you say to me, I'll do. Come on down now and curse me this people. Balaam answered. He said to the servants of Balak, if Balak would give me his whole house, if he gave me the whole, you can hear it almost, can't you? Now, this is one of those things, too. There are several ways to read this. Admittedly, I'm going to read it the first way. If Balak would give me his whole house full of silver and gold, I cannot go beyond the word of Yahuwah, my God, to do anything small or great. Should I say wink, wink, nudge, nudge? It's not clear. Maybe he's being straight. And two, what I'm trying to point out as we go through here is, when you look at this character, there are always more than one way to understand what's going on with him and his motivation. Maybe two-faced is another interesting way to put it. So he says to these guys, I pray you, hang out here, stay with me overnight. Maybe I'll see what Yahuwah will speak to me a little bit more. Maybe now that I've heard this better offer, I'll get a different word. Well, remember, he's already got the answer. He's been told. Elohim comes to Balaam at night, and he said to him, if the men are come to call you, rise up. Go with them. If the men come to you, rise up and go with them. But still, he's telling him again, the only word which I speak to you is what you shall do. Balaam rose up in the morning. Now, we do not see Scripture telling us the men came to him. What we got instead is Balaam getting up and saying, hey, that's close enough. He rose up, he saddled his ass, he went with the princes of Moab. Now Elohim is angry. Again, I kind of have always read this to say, he said, if they come to call you. But we get the impression Balaam was raring to go. Probably beat the guys out of bed. I don't know that. But what we do know is that whatever happened, now Elohim is upset. Perhaps he's upset because he knew exactly what was going on anyway. And there's an old saying. Let's see if I can remember what the Hebrew terminology is. Yeah, I don't have it. It's in here somewhere. You'll see it when you look at some of the Midrash on the story. In English, we would say he made his bed, he's going to lie in it. Right, a way which the man intends to go anyway, Yah will generally let him. He's not going to stop you as a general rule. Not that there aren't some occasional exceptions, but if you're bound and determined to head down the road to ruin, he will give you every opportunity to repent, but ultimately say, all right, I gave you free choice. And that's what's happening with Balaam here. Does not mean that Elohim isn't angry. So he went. Here comes the angel, the messenger, the Malak of Yahuwah, placed himself in the way as an adversary against him. Now, here comes Balaam. Now, I'm going to say it the way it's written in Scripture. By the way, for those of you that have not heard the term before, a male of this particular species is generally called a donkey. The female is referred to as an ass, just like Among dogs, the female is referred to as a bitch. It's not a polite term. Doesn't get used as often anymore for that reason. However, that is the correct English. So, in most of the correct translations of the English, because the donkey is a female, she is properly referred to as an ass. And what's ironic about it is, if you think about how much the Torah has preserved the humor here, even in the English language, people still talk about Balaam's ass. Right? I mean, think about it. Here is a fellow who was a great prophet, renowned in his time. If there were televangelists of the day, he was at the top of the heap. His name is still on the pottery. And yet, what do people remember about him? The ass knew better what was going on than he did. There's a, you know, don't ever say that the creator of the universe does not have a sense of humor. There's an old Hebrew saying I like. It says, man plans and God laughs. So it's what we're seeing here. The ass saw the angel of Yahuwah standing in the way, sword in his hand. And the female donkey turned aside. She went out in the field. Balaam was upset. He smote. The ass turned her right back. Then the angel of Yahuwah stood in a hollow way between the vineyards. What you're going to see here is that the way is getting narrower and narrower. And ultimately, we're going to have a showdown. So now we've got a little narrower spot. The Malach of Yahuwah stands in a hollow way between vineyards. A fence on this side, a fence on that side. The ass is still looking, still sees the angel of Yahuwah, thrust herself against the wall. This time she smashed Balaam's foot against the wall. Whoa, now he's upset. He whacks on her some more. And then the angel of Yahuwah went further, stood in a narrow place. There was no way to turn. This is, by the way, that scriptural metaphor comes over and over again. Turn not to the right nor to the left. Well, now the way is so narrow, the ass cannot turn to the right nor to the left. She sees the angel of Yahuwah. She lays down under Balaam. Now, you know, I'm looking at this thinking, this is a fine ass. Seriously, this is an animal that is doing the right thing. She's taken her master's life, and whether he knows it or not, she's protecting him. She lays down under Balaam. He's angry now. He smote the ass with his staff. And now we have the ultimate, you know, this is one of those, you'll hear me talk about occasionally what I call the minimum necessary miracle in Scripture, right? And sometimes the minimum necessary miracle in order to accomplish the purposes of the Almighty is bigger than it is other times. We've all seen little miracles, little things we say, well, that was a miracle. And yet when we tell the story, people say, well, it might be a miracle, but might not be. Well, we know it was a miracle. Well, here is the place, you know, you go to the other end of the spectrum, the parting of the Red Sea, the having the sun stand still in the heavens. These are clearly major deals. Ain't much arguing about those. And this one comes pretty close. We have a talking ass. That doesn't happen very often. The funny thing to me, among other things, is here that Balaam just is, this is perfectly okay. It does not seem to strike him as unusual. The Lord, or Elohim, Yahuwah, opened the mouth of the ass, and she says unto Balaam, now what have I done to you that you have smitten me now these three times? Balaam says to the ass, well, because you have mocked me. If I had a sword in my hand, I'd have killed you outright. And the ass then says to Balaam, am I not your ass, upon whom you've ridden all your life long up until this day? Was I ever wont to do anything like this to you before? Well, no. Now, think about this. You can just picture this ass reasoning with Balaam, right? Has this ever happened before? Are you going to ask yourself the question, why now? And by the way, why am I talking to you about it? Then Yahuwah opens the eyes of Balaam. He sees the Melech, the angel, the messenger, standing in the way with his sword drawn in his hand. And now, Balaam, you could say his eyes were open. He gets it. He fell on his face. Yahuwah, through the messenger, says to him, where and why have you now smitten your ass these three times? Behold, I have come forth as an adversary to you, because your way is contrary to me. Your ass saw me. She turned aside before me three times. And surely, if she had not done that by now, I would have slain you and left her alive. Balaam said to the angel of Yahuwah, well, I've sinned. I didn't know that you stood there in the way against me, so if this displeases you, I'll get me back, if this displeases you. You think? So the angel of Yahuwah says unto Balaam, go with the men, but Let me say this one more time so that it gets to only the word that I speak unto you, that you'll speak. So Balak continues to go the way he was intent on going all along. When he hears that the king, Balak, hears that Balaam has come, he went out to meet him and on the border of Arnon, the uppermost part of the border. He says, the king says to Balaam, "Didn't I earnestly send unto you to call you? Why didn't you come? Am I not indeed able to promote you in honor? Can't I do what I've been saying?" Balaam says to Balak, "Yo, I'm here. And have I any power to speak anything? The word that Elohim puts in my mouth, that is what I shall speak." He's finally starting to get the message. Balaam goes to Balak. They both came together to a place called Kiriath Huzot. And Balak sacrificed oxen and sheep, sent to Balaam. Princes that were with him. Came to pass in the morning, Balak the king took Balaam, brought him up to Bamot Baal, and from there to the uttermost part of the people. He saw all of these folks. And the prophet says unto Balak, "Build me here seven altars, prepare seven bulls and seven rams." So the king does as Balaam asked. They offered on every one of them a bull and a ram. And the prophet says to Balak, "Stand by the burnt offering, I'll go. Maybe Yahuwah will come to meet me, and whatever he shows me, I will tell you." Elohim meets Balaam. He says to him, "I've prepared the seven altars. I've offered up a bull and a ram on every one of them, and Yahuwah put a word in his mouth." So here we find the prophet literally has a word from Elohim. "Return unto Balak, and here's what you are to tell him." He took up his parable, and he said, "From Aram Balak bring me, the king of Moab from the mountains of the east. Come, curse me, Jacob. Come, execrate Israel." King is anxious to hear what's going to come out here. "How shall I curse," comes the response, "whom Elohim has not cursed? And how shall I execrate whom the Lord, whom Yahuwah, has not execrated? From the top of the rocks I see him. From beyond the hills I behold him. Lo, it's a people that shall dwell alone and shall not be reckoned among the nations. Who has counted the dust of Jacob or numbered the stock of Israel? Let me die the death of the righteous and let my end be like his." I'm listening to this. I'm thinking, that doesn't sound much like a curse, does it? Balak says unto Balaam, "What have you done to me? I took you and I asked you to curse my enemies, and behold, now you've blessed them." And he says, "Hey, look, don't I have to take heed to speak that which Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh puts in my mouth?" "All right," says the king, "come on, I pray you. Let's go somewhere else where you can check them out again. You'll see another place. You'll not see them all. Curse them from there." "That'll work. Let's go somewhere else. Try it from there." So he takes him into a field of Zophim, the top of Pisgah. "We're going to build seven more altars," and the same thing, ram and a bull on every one. King hears from the prophet, "Stand here by the burnt offering. I'm going to go over to a meeting over yonder." Yahuwah comes to Balaam. He puts a word in his mouth and says, "Here, this is what you can tell him this time." Well, when he gets back to the king, what's the word? He took up his parable and he said, "Arise, Balak, and hear. Give ear unto me, you son of Zippor. Elohim is not a man that he should lie, neither the son of man that he should shuv, repent. When he has said, won't he do it? Or when he has spoken, will he not make it good? Behold, I am bidden to bless. What he has blessed, I cannot call it back. None hath beheld iniquity in Jacob, nor has anyone seen perverseness in Israel. Yahuwah, his Elohim, is with him, and the shouting for the king is among them. God who brought them forth out of Egypt is for them like the lofty horns of the wild ox. There's no enchantment with Jacob, nor is there any divination with Israel. Now, is it said of Jacob and of Israel, what hath God wrought? Behold, people that rise up as a lioness, as a lion does he lift himself up. He doesn't lie down until he eats of the prey or drinks the blood of the slain." Now Balak, he's listening again. He's still waiting for the curse. He says this time, neither curse them at all nor bless them at all. I'm thinking maybe I just want you not to say anything at this point. Balaam answered and he told Balak, "Didn't I tell you, saying all that Yahuwah speaks, that I must do?" So the king says to him, "Come on now, I'll take you to yet another place." You got to wonder about Balak too. maybe you can curse them from there. It almost begins to sound a bit like Dr. Seuss, you know. I do not like them, Sam, I am. Well, you know, how about in a bar, in a car, would you like them from a jar? But Balak is going to keep trying. And by the way, you know the responses are going to keep getting better and better. Balaam now says to Balak, build me here 7 altars. Let's go through the same drill again. Balak did, as he had been told. And when Balaam saw that it pleased Yahuwah to bless Israel, he didn't go, as the other times, to meet with enchantment, but he set his face toward the wilderness. He lifted up his eyes, and he saw Israel dwelling tribe by tribe, and the spirit of Elohim came upon him. Here the prophet is going to get a whole different kind of a vision. Took up his parable, and he said, the saying of Balaam, son of Beor, the saying of the man whose eye is opened, the saying of him who hears the words of Elohim, who sees the vision of the Almighty fallen down yet with open eyes. Now this is probably one of the most famous prophecies in all of Scripture. How goodly are thy tents, O Yaakov, thy dwellings, O Israel, as valleys stretch out, as gardens by the riverside, as aloes planted by Yahuwah, as cedars beside the waters. Water shall flow from his branches, and his seed shall be in many waters, and his king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. Elohim, who brought him forth out of Egypt, is for him like the lofty horns of the wild ox. He shall eat up the nations that are his adversaries, and shall break their bones in pieces, and pierce them through with his arrows. He couched, he lay down as a lion and as a lioness. Who shall rouse him up? Blessed be every one that blesses thee, cursed every one that curses you. Balak has had enough. Now he's downright angry. He smote his hands together. Balak says to him, I called you to curse mine enemies, and behold, now you've altogether blessed them these 3 times. So get back home to your place. I thought I was going to promote you to great honor, but Yahuwah has kept you back from this honor. There's no small amount of irony there. Didn't I tell your messengers that even if he gave me his whole house full of silver and gold, I cannot go beyond the word of Yahuwah to do good or bad of my own mind, but I got to speak what I shall speak? Now behold, I go to my people. I'm going to announce to you what this people will do to your people in the end of days. He's not done yet. Got one more. Took up his parable, he said, the saying of Balaam, the son of Beor, the saying of the man whose eyes open, him who hears the words of Elohim, who knows the knowledge of the Most High, sees the vision of the Almighty fallen down yet with open eyes, I see him but not now, I behold him but not nigh. There shall step forth a star out of Yaakov, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel, and shall smite through the corners of Moab, and break down all the sons of Set. And Edom shall be a possession. Seir also, even his enemies, shall be a possession, while Israel does valiantly. Out of Yaakov shall one have dominion, and shall destroy the remnant from the city. He looked out on Amalek, and he took up his parable, and he said, Amalek was the first of nations, but his end shall come to destruction. He looked on the Kenite, took up his parable, and he said, though firm be thy dwelling place, and though thy nest be set in the rock, nevertheless Cain shall be wasted. How long? Ashur shall carry you away captive. He took up his parable. He said, alas, who shall live after Elohim has appointed him? Ships shall come from the coast of Kittim. They shall afflict Ashur and shall afflict Eber. And he also shall come to destruction. So, Balaam goes up. He heads home. So does Balak. Now, interestingly enough, we have not heard the end of Balaam yet. This is back to this idea of character a little bit. I'm going to skip ahead. We'll talk about this more in a subsequent Torah portion. I forget now if it's next week or the week after. But we're going to see more of Balaam. It's enough separation in time that sometimes people forget it. But essentially, Balaam still seems to have his eye on the prize, the big bucks, the glory that he's been kept from. And you kind of get the idea he's a little bit of a conniver as well. We know, if we've read ahead in the book, what his scheme is going to be. Look, I can't curse these people, but maybe you can bring them to a point where they curse themselves. I know what'll do it. A little sex, right? We'll send the women of Moab down, entice them into getting the men to go off into the tents with them, and then maybe we can get them to chase after other gods too. Aha. Israel will end up cursing itself. This is the kind of cleverness. This is actually what I would call lawyerese. I've talked about it being Clinton speak and sometimes, right? All depends on what the meaning of the word, you got to tell them what I'm going to tell you to tell them, is. But maybe we'll have another way around. Oh, look. Here you go. Chapter 25 says, Israel abode in Shittim. The people began to commit harlotry with the daughters of Moab. We're not told yet, we will, why. They called the people unto the sacrifices of those foreign gods, the Canaanite gods. They eat, they bow down to their gods. And Israel joined himself unto Baal of Peor, and the anger of Yahuwah was kindled against Israel. Yahuwah said unto Moshe, take all the chiefs of the people, hang them up unto Yahuwah in the face of the sun, and the fierce anger of Yahuwah may turn away from Israel. Moses says to the judges of Israel, slay every one of these men who have joined themselves unto these false gods, Baal of Peor. And behold, one of the children of Israel came up and brought unto his brethren a Midianitish woman in the sight of Moshe, in the sight of all of the congregation of the children of Israel, right there in flagrante delecto, they would say, while they were weeping at the door of the tent of meeting. And now we see this fellow, Pinchas. We're going to talk about him next week, next week's portion, because this one ends at verse 9. Pinchas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron the priest, saw it. He takes a spear in his hand, and he runs the man and the woman both through, right smack there in their tent, through the belly. The plague was stayed. That was the end of it for now. Those that died by the plague, 24,000. A lot of folks. Got a question? Well, kind of, sort of. Yeah, the comment was because of two people. They were already dying before. I guess what I'm going to suggest is that was kind of the climax, the culmination of it, where Pinchas has had enough. But it sounds like this was already going on. So, you know, think about what we've got today. We've got a whole bunch of things that the creator of the universe calls abomination. And there's a line from James Madison. He says, the time to object to something is when the principle is first violated. Don't wait until it has been strengthened by exercise. Nip it in the bud, in other words. So we've got people turning after foreign gods, going to these women and going, oh, yeah, yeah, a little bit of nookie, and I'm happy to bow down to that foreign god there. Pinchas had finally had enough, and it was the in-your-face aspect of this that really, at this point, shows that the whole thing is out of control. I guess that's what we're really seeing in America today. We'll come back to that when we talk about the news. A lot of things that are literally out of control. All right. Let me see if there's not one or two more things we can say about Bilaam. Kind of in summary, first, I've already mentioned the idea of Bilaam and the talking donkey. Here's a nice comment from one of the rabbis that writes today. This is a fellow I talk about occasionally, Jonathan Sachs. It's pure humor, he says. One thing provokes divine laughter, and that's this concept of human pretension. Here you got a guy that's a prophet, and unlike Moshe, you want to look for a difference between Moshe and Bilaam. Well, one aspect is hubris. Moshe is meek and teachable. Balaam seems to have his nose rubbed in it before he finally begins to get it. I guess, ultimately, the question that we need to be asking ourselves, are we more like Balaam, or are we more like Moshe? Sadly, I can probably say, you know, I got more in common with Balaam, whether I like to admit it or not, than I do with Moshe when it comes to some of that. It's necessary for us to sometimes, I've referred to having had, you know, the creator of the universe take the divine two before, kind of rear back and whack you right across the chops with it. Sometimes that's what we need to have. That's what happened with Balaam. Basically, he was shown this. You think you're a prophet? I got a talking donkey that sees more than you do. Man is led down the path he chooses to lead, no question. Now, essentially, one of the comments in this particular one, this is a nice way of summarizing it, too. I asked the question up front, what kind of prophet are we talking about here? Answer, a prophet who doesn't like to be told no. Right? He asked the question. The first words that he heard were no. He doesn't like to hear that. None of us like to hear no. Even Moshe, I guess, if you think about it, is not particularly anxious to hear that you're not going to be able to go into the land. But he took it better than most of us probably would have in the same situation. There is this concept of tough love. We don't know exactly what happened with Bilaam, other than that we know that subsequent portion he dies as a result of what he has accomplished here. I guess he died with some gold and silver blessing. The sages will say that ultimately, if you compare Moshe to the prophets of Israel, he evidently what he said often was true. Somehow or other, he did manage to communicate with the Almighty. That's an interesting. What do you make of that? A lot of us would be thrilled, right, to be able to take up our oracle, the parable, and speak the way Bilaam did, to speak the words of Yod Heh Vav Heh. But this guy took it in the wrong way, with a haughty spirit. Some even have called himself evil. I guess when all is said and done, the thing that probably resonates with me about Bilaam and not wanting to hear no is, and maybe this is the thing to take away from it, he is able to lie to himself. He is able to say to himself, well, I think God left me a little opening there. Maybe I didn't quite hear him right. Maybe I'll ask again. Maybe if I do this, maybe if I do that. Oh, and then finally, his undoing. Maybe since I cannot do or say what he is telling me not to say, and I have to say what he does tell me to say, maybe I got an end run around it. Maybe I can tell Balak how to entice Israel to do themselves in, right? He's always looking for the out. He's lying to himself. And I guess ultimately that ends up being the mark of the false prophet as opposed to the true. The true prophet speaks the words of the Almighty and doesn't necessarily inject himself into the equation. Any comments or questions? I guess that's a good place to stop for now. We'll talk about some other things in a little while. And I'm also going to make a reference as well to another prophet in a few minutes that is Micah. And it's the Haftorah portion that is considered to go along with this. There's a reference, of course, to Balaam and Balak in the prophecy of Micah. That's part of the reason why I'm sure it goes with this. But it also goes with some other things that are going on in the world, too. So we will be back after one more song, and we will talk about what is going on in the world nowadays.
From all wrong, I'll be satisfied as long as I walk. Let me walk close to thee, just a closer walk with
just a closer walk.
Just a closer walk.
Grant
Yeshua
this my
just a closer walk.
Just a closer walk.
Daily
walking
close to
thee.
Let
it be,
Yeshua,
let it
be.
Blessed
life is
o'er.
Time
for me
will form. Guide me gently, safely o'er to your kingdom shore, to your shore. Just a closer walk with just a closer walk, just a closer walk. Grant Yeshua this my just a closer walk, just a closer walk. Daily walking close to thee, let it be, Yeshua, let it be. A closer walk with just a closer walk, just a closer walk. Grant Yeshua this my just a closer walk, just a closer walk. Daily walking close to thee, let it be, Yeshua, let it be. Daily walking close to thee, let it be, Yeshua, let it be.
So let's talk a bit about the news and about what's going on in the world. And of course, I guess because this is the anniversary of a day that, I'm going to say it bluntly, most Americans are completely ignorant about. Oh yeah, it's 4th of July, man. It's fireworks, barbecues. You think there might be any more to it? Let's see. Was there a war? I wish I was kidding. But I think probably there's a lot more ignorance about what it is that people are celebrating today than I wish there was. That's putting it mildly. We'll come back to that in just a second. Bear in mind that, as always, the question here is, do we know the times and the seasons? Are we understanding what's going on? Can we be like the men of Issachar, know what Israel ought to do? So let's start earlier in the week. On Monday, we had some international stuff that happened. Saudi and CIA terror army, I like this headline, declares an official caliphate on Ramadan. This is ISIS, conveniently named after a pagan deity. I'm sure there's just no coincidence there. And they basically announced that they've got a 5-year expansion plan, and it includes a major Islamic caliphate over much of the Middle East, including parts of Israel, or all if they have their way, the Arabian Peninsula, North Africa, Afghanistan, Pakistan, even into Indonesia and India. The Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham, that was where the ISIS acronym came from when he translated a couple times, the terror army that was supported by Saudi Arabia, trained by the United States in Jordan, and as it turned out, whether they admit it or not, directly armed with all kinds of American armament. I've got this other story here. ISIS weapons windfall. This is even from the Los Angeles Times. Now, they don't admit the truth, which is this couldn't have happened if there weren't some significant issues, I guess, to put it mildly. Anyway, the fact that ISIS has been armed by the U.S. may alter the balance in Iraq and in the Syrian conflicts. I went through this story earlier in the week. The L.A. Times even changed some of the terminology to soft pedal some of this, but at least they're admitting the truth. And that is that ultimately, these so-called terrorists, and they really are terrorists, it would look like, given the videos that they've been releasing, were trained and armed by the U.S., and they've declared their caliphate. Their spokesperson, the shadowy character whose name is Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of the caliphate, has said, come on, Muslims, come on home. And he declared a new international era of jihad. All right. I guess we'll wait, see what happens on that score, as if we can't already begin to see certain aspects of how that'll shape up. Here's another piece of news that didn't get as much coverage as it probably deserves to. Maybe I'll talk a little bit more about this tomorrow, because I didn't want to spend a lot of time on some of the economics. You got to follow the money. And the United States Department of Just Us came after BNP Paribas, a French bank, with tongs. And the French bank caved. They agreed to pay almost $9 billion in a fine because they were facilitating transactions. Now, the U.S. can arm the terrorists, but when BNP Paribas allegedly facilitates various kinds of transactions, they're called money laundering if the wrong terrorists get it. It's called policy, I guess, if the right terrorists get it. Anyway, these were banned transactions between 2004-2012, and the Just Us Department said the bank's going to pay the money and then be barred. Now, how is it that the United States is sanctioning a foreign bank? Oh, yeah. Well, because they're transacting in fiat dollars. They also required 13 executives to resign, leave the bank. I guess the good news is they did not have to be Arkansided. Putin slammed the $9 billion fine, saying it was blackmail for a Russian warship deal. Jim Willing, on the other hand, says no, the real problem is that BNP Paribas was involved in selling some U.S. treasuries, probably for Russia and similar ones too. In other words, we're not hearing the whole story. If you want to follow the money, you get a better understanding of just what's going on behind the scenes. Back to so-called Independence Day. Here's a piece from Michael Snyder. Writes pretty prolifically. He is pointing to a Gallup survey, which has been asking a certain question year after year after year. How are you, Mr. and Mrs. America and American Pie, how you doing with the level of freedom, or conversely, the level of tyranny in the United States? Turns out that almost 4 out of 5 people, tyranny? What tyranny? I'm okay with it, I guess. Trade a little rights for a little temporary security? Yeah, no problem. So something like 79% of Americans, says the story, are fine with the current level of tyranny. Now, by the way, if you go back to the Revolutionary War, and most of the historians will say, hey, an interesting thing. During the time of the Revolutionary War, about 10% of the U.S. populace, the colonists, were fans of the king. They were Tories, as they were called. 10% called themselves patriots. They were in favor of separation from Great Britain. Guess what? 80%, the vast majority, just not like now, didn't know, didn't care. A lot of folks will point out, and I remember this being a surprise to me when I first heard this number, it's been 20 years ago now. Of the 10%, though, that were patriots, that believed in separation from Great Britain, coming out of her, withdrawing consent, how many actually took up arms? Answer, 1 in 3 of the 10%. So, those who fought during the Revolution were about 3% of the population. In other words, a very small minority actually willing to pledge their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor and do something about it. Those are all interesting numbers. Now, I want to do one or two more stories, then I'm going to talk a little bit about the things that those 80% just plain don't know about. Obama's threat to change immigration laws without Congress. I don't need Congress. I got my pen, got my phone. He'll just do whatever he wants. Congress doesn't like it, but hey, he's the emperor. What can they do about it? I'm going to fix it on my own, he says. Yeah, we know how he's fixing it. We've got this story, and this kind of stuff's almost just, you know, cannon fodder anymore. These stories are so common, they're you tend to almost ignore them. U.S. officials, it says, this is a piece from the Washington Post, disclosed data on their backdoor searches of America's phone calls and emails. So here the Washington Post coming right out and saying, oh, yeah, they got backdoors, and they're doing all this stuff, warrantless searches and seizures. We don't even know how many times it's going on nowadays. But it's okay. We don't worry about that anymore. Stingray, the cell phone spying device. U.S. government has disappeared the records. We've talked about this before. You don't need to know. Here's from Blackwater. there were probes going on in Iraq of some of the criminal activities from the public-private partnership there. Turns out that the private partners in Blackwater had all kinds of violations. They were doing things without State Department approval and so forth and so on, and keeping automatic weapons. Remember, these are weapons that you peons aren't allowed to have as a general rule and so forth. And there was a probe that was going on. Turns out that the probe was deep sixed. And it turns out that the Blackwater above-the-law personnel evidently threatened to kill the investigators. So the investigators, rather than being killed, killed the investigation. There are, you know, story after story after story of like this. From the Washington Times, federal authorities are directing airports to update their security screening procedures. Yeah, that'll fix it. Here's where I want to go next. Some of you may remember, this is 4th of July, right? Oh, yeah. No, it's really the Independence Day. Well, what was the big deal about Independence Day? Turns out that actually the real miracle, if you will, the unanimous consent happened on July 2nd. That was the day that John Adams thought that should be celebrated with fireworks. But it really got signed a couple of days later. Remember the famous line, John Hancock signed it big, and he said, hey, come on, guys, we got to have some other signatures on here. If they busted us now, if the king's troops came in, my signature is the only one on this thing. So they, most of them, signed it on July 4th, pledging their lives and their fortunes and their sacred honor. I have gone through this literally every year, talking about the importance of this document. Bottom line really is this. The second paragraph is the one that I think is the most important single thing ever written in the English language, originally. And it's the one that says, we hold these truths to be self-evident. In other words, obvious, undeniable. Everybody who literally should call themselves an American, if you're looking for a single definition, it's, are these truths self-evident to you? Do you understand that it says here, all men are created equal, in other words, equal before the law and before their creator, and they are endowed by their creator with certain rights. They're called unalienable, cannot be leaned by any government of men, and that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The whole point of government, it says, is to secure these rights. And furthermore, here's the politically incorrect part. When a government becomes abusive, destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it. And furthermore, talk about political correctness and conspiracy theories run amok. These fellows actually said that when there's a long train of abuses and usurpations that pursues invariably the same object, how do they know? Maybe they can connect the dots, because certain things are just plain obvious, at least they used to be. When this long train of abuses evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it's not only their right, it is their duty to throw off such government, to come out of her, to withdraw their consent. And then they go on to say, hey, that's what we're talking about here. The history of the present king of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. And he says, let facts be submitted to a candid world. This is the indictment. There's a whole string of things here. This is the place where I wanted to pause for a second. I'm not going to read the whole thing. I just want to read a couple, because we've already gone through some of the news this week. I'm going to go through just a teeny bit more in a second here. Ask yourself, though, does any of the concern, this long train of abuses that the founders saw so clearly in 1776, but that 80% then and 80% now are still blind to, woefully ignorant of, does any of that apply nowadays? Here's probably my favorite in this whole thing, because it still rings so true. This is the evil king that was a despot and a tyrant. I will suggest that just maybe if you compare him to the last few evil kings that the United States has had, George III was a little bit of a piker. Our own George the Lesser was doing things that George III couldn't even dream of. And, of course, Obama has taken it another couple of warp factor four Mr. Sulu steps beyond that. So here's the indictment. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. Let me just ask it as a question. Do the letters TSA, IRS, DHS, DEA, FBI, do they mean anything? EPA, CPS, stealing children. The czars, yeah, we got a million czars. How many? 51? Too many czars to name. Swarms of new officers sent here to harass our people. Anybody heard about DEA and FDA officials literally making armed raids on people trying to sell raw milk to willing customers? Or busting people for their gardens? Or the EPA saying you can't build on this land because a glancing goose might see a puddle? And if you think that's bad, we're going to take the runoff from your garden hose and use that to take your land? Eat out your substance? Oh, yeah. Now, here's where it really gets interesting. This is the thing that I'm going to focus on for the next couple of minutes. Not just these new officers eating out people's substance, but the thing that one of the founders, George Mason, called the bane of liberty. He said a standing army is the bane of liberty. If you read the Constitution, you'll see that they said that there's no appropriation for an army in the United States, it's to last more than 2 years. They once required this thing that almost very few people still alive have ever seen used. It was called a declaration of war. Now, a navy, the United States could have a navy during times of peace. But an army? Mm-mm. Because a standing army was considered a very great danger. It was the people themselves that could be armed via the militia. Well, here's the indictment. He has kept among us, in times of peace, standing armies without the consent of our legislature. How many bullets did DHS buy? 2 billion? 4 or 5 rounds for every man, woman, and child of the United States? Hollow points, the kind of things that aren't allowed to be used by the Geneva Convention in war against foreign enemies, but evidently are okay to be used against Americans. Standing army. He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. We used to have a thing called posse comitatus, not anymore. The emperor just announced a while ago, oh, we're going to drone people? Yeah, we can do that. We can do all kinds of things. We can deploy the army on U.S. soil. We can send our MRAPs and other SWAT team kinds of equipment to basically turn the local cops into adjuncts of a military independent of and superior to the civil power. He is affected, combined with others, to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation. They're called presidential decision directives and executive orders now. And then he says this, for quartering large bodies of armed troops among us. Again, pick 3 letters, IRS, DEA, DHS. They're all armed. For the most part, if you live in a major city, you, on the other hand, will not find it so easily. There's a whole lot more. But it's just interesting to point out that what their response is to say, in every stage of these oppressions, we've petitioned for redress in the most humble terms, but we've been answered only by repeated injury. A prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. They close by saying that with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. You'll find in this document 4 specific references to the creator of the universe. 3 of them, other than creator itself, come right smack out of Isaiah chapter 33. And none of them are allowed in the public schools anymore. So we can see how far we've come, and it bugs me, you know, that people are out sitting around the United States today. They had a barbecue this afternoon. They're watching the fireworks. Most of them have never read this document. They're not going to hear it in the schools. And all the while, the things that are happening around them that they're ignorant of are sadly light years beyond the things that were happening then. One of the big deals with the colonists was something called a general warrant, where the redcoats could literally just barge in and say, we're going to search your property. Well, duh. We don't even have warrants anymore. NSA just does it. They search your papers, houses, effects, emails, listen to your computers, your cell phones, turn them on and monitor. They want something in your house, we don't need a warrant. We'll just bust down the door. Oh, wrong door, we shot your dog? Eh, you might want to clean that mess up. Folks, this is the kind of stuff that the people of the United States, before it was the United States, wouldn't have put up with. And yet Americans today, sadly, for the most part, are just plain ignorant of it. Now, this is where I want to go with the last two stories. And I think it'll make the point, having to do with standing armies, quartering among us large bodies of troops, rendering the military superior to the civil power. Oh, there's even this one. I am going to read this one, too. And I'm going to change one word, see if you can tell. He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us. Do you think maybe we have a president today and a Congress that are literally trying to incite a civil war in the United States? I can't argue with the claim that that's what was going on in Nevada. And that it, had it not been cooler heads that prevailed in the form of an armed response to support Clive and Bundy, given that the BLM, so many three-letter agencies, hard to, had brought armed snipers to the ranch, and they were killing this guy's cattle. What was the word here? Sent hither swarms of BLM officers to harass our people and eat out their substance, kill their cattle. Yeah. Trying to excite domestic insurrections among us. Now get this. You're going to hear more about this in just a second. And he has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers. Now I'm thinking southern border in particular when I read our frontiers. The merciless Muslim savages, I changed one word in that sentence, whose known rule of warfare, have you seen the videos from ISIS? Is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. Folks, they have been carving off people's heads. They have been driving down the streets, videoing it, and putting this stuff on YouTube, proud of it. Passers-by walking down the streets of Iraq, executed, fully auto machine guns, out of cars. They're driving down the highways and literally opening up on vehicles in the other lane, executing everybody in there. Whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. Asking people, are you a Christian? This is exactly what's going on in the United States. This is why the southern border is open. This is why there are stories coming out this week about literally tens of thousands of people, not news, coming across the border. The real recent news, of course, is how many of them are supposedly children. Now, children includes up to late teenagers, 17, 18, 19 years of age, many of them with gang tattoos of some of the most violent and vicious, murderous gangs known in existence, MS-13 and the Zetas and several others, all coming across the border. But then there's this. This story came out this week from Fox. Todd Starnes has been picked up in a number of places. Medical staff at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, where they've been sending hundreds, they don't even know the numbers, they won't admit it because they're confidential, maybe thousands of children, all ages. Here's the story. A government contracted security force, by the way, who's the contractor? Something called the Baptist Family and Children's Services. Doesn't that sound special? These are armed goons. Baptist Family and Children's Services has threatened to arrest doctors and nurses if they divulge any information about the contagion threat at this refugee camp for these illegal aliens crossing the border en masse. People are literally dropping off the kids, thinking, well, the kids get in and we'll come in later. In spite of the threat, several former camp workers broke confidentiality agreements and they came public, sharing exclusive details with Todd Starnes, Fox author, about the dangerous conditions at the camps. They said taxpayers deserve to know about the contagion and the risk that these children pose to Americans. Now, I want people to remember, if you are silly enough, and I'm saying it bluntly, to put your kids in the public cesspools, the indoctrination centers, they are now being required to have vaccinations. We don't want unvaccinated children being a risk. And remember, FDA and DEA and others are so concerned about your health that they'll send armed teams, right, to bust people growing crops that they don't like and to take raw milk because they're so concerned about your health. Now, it's okay if it's GMO. That's different. And they're so concerned about your health that they've got children that they're busing and putting on planes all across the country who turn out to have, you can't begin to believe, all kinds of contagious diseases. From something called scabies to lice to who knows what else. But it's nasty. And at the same time, we're hearing stories from Africa. The Ebola contagion there is out of control. Do you think any of these could be coming across the border? How would you know? MERS, antibiotic-resistant TB. So at the same time, people are being told, oh, we're so concerned about your health that we're going to, well, come send armed SWAT teams and kill you for horribly nasty things like raw milk. We're going to put these kids on buses and bus them all over the country and threaten the doctors and nurses who are ready to blow the whistle on this whole thing with arrest for telling people about just how much contagion is being allowed to move across the border. Now, the good news is there's actually a lot of Border Patrol and customs folks who are disgusted, and some of them have resigned. One of the doctors said, this is a nurse, I guess, oh my God, they're flying these kids around. Nobody knows that these children have scabies and lice. To tell you the truth, there's no way to control it. I don't mean to upset anyone's Independence Day vacation plans, said the author, but were these kids transported into these camps and then moved all over the country before or after they were deloused? Anybody who flies the friendly skies could be facing some major health concerns. Some of these folks quit their jobs. Basically, oh, one other thing. The Baptist Family and Children's Services, the BCFS, wear brown shirts. And they call themselves the Brown Shirts. Anybody recognize the wonderful historic reference there to Hitler's Germany? And they call these silency, Achtung, you will be silent or else, regs, the brown shirt rules. There's a message here. And it's not the story that people are being told. Now, here comes story two. This is the one that, as a private pilot, I can tell you I've watched for years, and it bugs me. And now, at least, it's getting a little teeny bit of press. This is from the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, which is one of the groups that, probably one of the two main groups that represents pilots and, you know, lobbies for, well, against, I guess is a better way to put it, all the nasty, evil stuff that is being done to pilots to try to remove the freedom of flight from formerly free Americans. And one of the fellows involved, here's Senator Inhofe of Oklahoma, who has joined the fight. This is a piece that came out earlier this week from Roland Daily, against Department of Achtung, Homeland Security agents who come to eat out our substance. They have been harassing small-time aviators, general aviation pilots, who fly from one U.S. city to another, particularly small towns. They don't even come anywhere close to an international border. That's key. All right? Now, what are we talking? We're talking thousands of children dumped at the borders, being moved into concentration camps where disease evidently runs rampant, and they're being shipped all over the place. The doctors and nurses are being told, keep your mouths shut. Customs and Border Patrols are literally looking the other way, those that haven't resigned, while this mass flows across the border. Are they carrying other things, like weapons of mass destruction? Islamic terrorists? Representatives of ISIS? Who knows? Because the borders are porous. What are these people doing instead? What is the great challenge that they have to go do? Answer. They're sending armed SWAT teams to harass and eat out the substance of pilots who aren't anywhere close to a border that are flying their family in a four-place single-engine Cessna. Searches typically conducted by armed agents with the Customs and Border Patrol, TSA, and even local police SWAT teams working under DHS orders have also been involved. AOP's documented at least 50 of these since 2012, basically saying they were so bizarre at first that they couldn't believe this was really going on in a formerly free country. There was a case of a Cessna surrounded by dozens of armed, full auto-wielding SWAT team, we don't need no stinking warrant, agents, 40 officers, 26 vehicles, responding to a four-seat plane about the size of a Honda Civic. It was a man who was flying to a Florida vacation with his family. They were ordered out, surrounded by dogs. We don't need no stinking warrant. I'll read the line from the a lawyer who has been involved in trying to fight this, also a pilot. He says all of this is intimidation. They detain people, realistically, 20 federal agents coming with guns to harass our people and eat out their substance, saying we want to search your plane. Octung is not exactly a voluntary request. There's no search warrant. There's no probable cause. The raids have targeted largely small planes flying between small airports. Again, not anywhere close to a border in many cases. They are targeting, from my understanding, pleasure planes. Pilots who maybe didn't file a flight plan because, hey, there's no requirement to. There's no legal basis. People just got in their planes and flew. They're wasting hundreds of thousands of dollars. In some cases, they have scrambled F-16s, which in a little teeny sortie, folks, will burn more fuel in a matter of an hour than yours truly would burn flying coast to coast. What he says is they're wasting hundreds of thousands of dollars. They find nothing. Hey, but they did manage to trash the Constitution. All of this has a chilling effect on general aviation. Why? Is it just possible, folks, that they don't want people who have the ability to overfly the checkpoints, where they can say, your paper's bitta, so let's stop them at gunpoint and force the searches? Again, the contrast here is what I'm trying to emphasize. We got people streaming across the border like there is no border. We've got people having armed raids of, you know, farms, and taking stuff that people would like to buy. Pick a crop. Non-genetically modified. Raw milk. And meanwhile, the same folks that are telling you this is all about your safety are ignoring the borders, doing things that they have no lawful basis to do internally, harassing people and eating out their substance, while the contagion runs rampant. And 80% of all Americans are utterly ignorant of not only that, but, of course, their own law and their own history, too. It's a time to be concerned. I mention all of this, and I'll say this one last thing, too, and that is we are at a place, right? Be like the men of Issachar. Know the time and the season. Know what Israel should do. Where those of us who are going to the barbecues, there'll be more fireworks tomorrow and the next day. There'll be more celebrations of people, well, they know not what. Pull out a copy of the Declaration. Ask them, have you ever read this? Do you understand that our rights come from God? No, not the God that has those black robe justices in the Supreme Court. The God of the Bible. That's the one that the founders referenced four times in that declaration document. All those things that they were concerned about, you can see them happening today. Well, if you have eyes to see and ears to hear. Are you aware of it? Do you understand why it is that we're told in Scripture, come out of her, my people. Don't participate. Know the times and the seasons. Know what Israel should do. It's getting really, really late. And it's more and more important.